comes to purchasing houses and sorting out matters relating to house purchases and such like, you might sort of think, well, it's an adult thing. But it would seem that children and teenagers have got their own particular take on the joys of buying a house or indeed a flat. I must admit, a lot of sympathy with the notion that one in 10 people aged between 18 and 21 thinks stamp duty is money to pay for stamps. Apart from that, who could we possibly contact to actually provide some insight into this fantastic survey and indeed talk about money, property and so on and such like, other than the awesome, and I say that again, awesome twosome that are effectively the legends of Dick and Dom. Dick and Dom, welcome to the programme. How are you both?
Thank Double you awesome. Much. Thank you.
Yeah, no, we're fine, thank you.
Marvellous. Hey,
who would have thought that years ago, about 12 years ago, we were teaching kids how to shout bogeys in public places. And now here we are teaching the same generation who are all grown up and wonderful how to buy a house.
Yeah, because we had a bungalow, but it got repossessed, unfortunately. So,
Of course, and Dick and Dom in the bungalow. We do actually have one of those children who you have influenced with us now as a 21-year-old, Eva McDonald.
That is me.
Yep.
Hi, Eva.
Hello.
Hey, hello. Are you a bungalow generation, are you?
I am a bungalow generation. Watched it every Saturday.
Oh, fantastic. It was good time. It was crazy days of television when the rule book was very, very thin. So we just went in and carved up television on Saturday morning. Had great fun.
It was. I was sad I was never on it.
Oh, did you apply?
I don't know if we ever did. We just always said we would want to, but we never actually got there.
Well, listen, this is how long ago it was. When you wanted to apply to be on that show, you had to phone in or write into the BBC. They would then send you some pieces of paper, and you had to attach your passport photos to the forms that you then had to fill in and send back by post.
None of this internet stuff back
then. No,
I think I remember that.
That's how long ago it was.
Gosh,
as we said, just amazing. And the level of excitement when I mentioned that you're going to be with us today, Dick and Dom, with Eva. Well, just, I mean, she's now a collector of the set. You've worked with Chico Time, and you've also had the Chuckle Brothers. This basically makes her life complete.
Oh yes.
Well, we're in such good company.
Let's move on to the topic today, which of course is this property scenario, and again, children and teenagers knowing about buying a house and so on. Is this just a case of financial miseducation, that basically if we kind of installed more into schools to talk about education, etc., then maybe it would actually address this, or does it matter?
Pretty much. I think you've nailed it there. I think it's kind of, as parents, maybe we should be talking to our kids more about mortgages and what that entails. And at school as well, maybe in math lessons, we should be actually bringing in mortgages, stamp duty, deposits, you know, how you handle these kind of things in the future.
Eva, you've had a look at the research. Any things sprang to mind from your own perspective?
I don't think, when I was in school, we never really had lessons on buying houses, and we never really had lessons on
what
stamp
duty was. Too many people saying bogeys and playing that, you know.
It wasn't really a subject that was touched on, really, which I think was obviously not very good, because it's very important, I think. I mostly learnt all the lessons through my mother, and I mean, even now, thinking about it, I only know a little bit more about it just through asking my mother.
But you don't think stamp duty is money to pay for stamps, no?
No. No, I know.
One in ten think that it is.
No,
and
the thing is, it's
kind of understandable. I mean, why would someone who is living the early years of their life and going out and having fun, why would they even know what stamp duty is? However, the thing is, and this is what we're trying to get across, is they will have to know about this. And so they don't have a kind of unrealistic view of these things. It's best to kind of just drip feed it into them now, and just let them be aware that when they buy a house, they don't just buy a house. They have to put down a deposit, they have to borrow from a bank, and they have to pay a large amount of tax as well.
Well, yeah, talking about deposits there, a lot of young people in this age category of 11 to 21, because all this research was done by the Halifax, so they asked a lot of 11 to 21 year olds, and a lot of them think a deposit is between 5 and 10 grand, when actually an average deposit is 32,000. So you've got to be kind of start saving in your teenage years, really.
I mean, that and going to university, there's 64 grand sorted out immediately in yeah. for you. So amazing.
It's a very expensive world. And it's one of the most important financial decisions you'll ever make in your life, buying your first home. Mm. And a lot of kids just assume you can borrow as much as you want, or they think that mum and dad will pay for it all, which isn't going to happen.
Well, I mean, Bank of Mum and Dad clearly could be a subsidiary of a Halifax or vice versa.
Yeah, well, don't forget, they were in a very different position. Like, people of our age, our mums and dads bought places for very small amounts of money. I know it was comparative back then, but now the amount of equity that they have compared to the size of their mortgage, if they have one at all, is large. So our parents' generation possibly could have helped us out. However, now we're in a very, very different situation. And the chances of most people now being able to pay off their mortgage by the end of the term, probably quite slim. We'll end up with quite a big mortgage.
I mean, Ava, have you thought about getting a mortgage, or have you started thinking about saving for a deposit?
I have. It's less of a problem at the moment because I work as an entertainer, so we already get our own little place sorted out for us. But I have thought about it in the future, so I have started up saving up a little
bit. Wow, good on you.
See, that's how it's changed since you guys were actually at the heart of the whole routine. Now entertainers in summer camps, they actually get their own places for them. It's amazing.
Well, we did have a bungalow, didn't we?
Well, exactly. Best place to go to find out further details, would it be to the Halifax website to find out more details about these kind of things? And maybe just a simple way in which people can, dealing with young folk, etc., start explaining the strategies they need to be thinking about?
Well, the most simplest one is the Halifax jargonbuster.co.uk. That basically explains everything there is to know about getting a mortgage. So if you're going to have a look at that, it should simplify it a bit.
Eva, any concluding thoughts that you'd like to share with us?
No, but I would suggest that it is a good idea to obviously have a look at the future and have a look at the possibilities of buying a house, because I think that's very important.
Eva speaks to somebody who's born in the 20th century as opposed to the youngsters these days born in the 21st century. Mm-hmm. Talk about photographs and writing in and W1A, it's a whole new world, really. Dick and Dom, it's been fabulous sharing some thoughts with your good self today. We've got two final questions for you. They're kind of 21st century customer satisfaction ones, really. First of all, have you both had a reasonably interesting telephonic link with us on the programme today?
The telephonic link has been extraordinary.
Marvellous. This is good. So the next critical question is, can we prevail upon you to perhaps join us again in the not-too-distant future? I mean, now we've moved up from the bogey game and so on. I think it's Dick and Dom to host Newsnight in the very near future.
Yeah. Yes, please.
Yeah, we'll go with that. Excellent. Yeah. Dick and Dom, we salute you.
Cheerio.
Take care.
Thank you.
Cheers.
Bye.
Bye.
Cheers.
I just had to come back one last time. Ma'am, I know you don't know me from Adam, but these handprints on the front steps are mine. Up those stairs in that little back bedroom is where I did my homework and I learned to play guitar. I bet you didn't know, under that live oak, my favorite dog is buried in the yard. I thought if I could touch this place, I'd feel it. This brokenness inside me might start healing. Just come in, I swear I'll leave. Won't take nothing but a memory from the house that built me. Mama cut out pictures of houses for years, from Better Homes and Garden magazines. Plans were drawn on concrete board, nail by nail and board by board. Daddy gave life to Mama's dream. But a memory from the house that built me.
wonderful when you're actually in the heart of a consumerist society where you can buy stuff and then actually buy more stuff to actually sort of replace the stuff that perhaps you didn't want in the first place. And certainly with the January sales being in full swing, you might well be considering bagging a bargain for bargain's sake. According to new research, of course, we are pretty good at it as far as Britain is concerned, especially when it comes to clothing and what we wear. Findings by Collect Plus has actually shown that we'll be spending approximately £176 per person on our 2018 wardrobes, but then we might decide we want to return the products after all. And to address this particular phenomenon of buyer's remorse, splurge then purge, who better than consumer fashion and brand psychologist extraordinaire, the amazingly talented Kate Nightingale. How are you, Kate?
Good morning. I'm well. Thank you very much.
Good.
Beautiful introduction.
It is only right, Kate. I mean, we feel as though when we join with your good self, we're always going to get sage, important advice from that point of view, which is important. So share with us this particular area in terms of the survey by Collect Plus about we buy the stuff and then we return it. I mean, is it just a case of should you not have made that decision in the first place as opposed to returning it? Or is it just a case of, oh, we shouldn't have actually got it after all?
It's not necessarily the case. You know, a lot of those purchases is going to be made online or in a rush during your lunch break or during a very sort of quick Christmas shopping. And we don't always have that amount of capacity in our brain for decision making at the time. So we don't sort of analyze all the pros and cons. Those decisions are very subconscious at that time, especially. And therefore, when we are actually able to sort of analyze that purchase a little bit more, decide whether it suits our lifestyle, our wardrobe, whether we feel good in it or not, and even, you know, whether it actually fits us, because they found out that major aspect of why people are actually returning is that it doesn't fit them properly. 47% of Brits said that, you know, that's the case. And, you know, a lot of it is due to online purchases and inavailability of digital fitting rooms that are working very well, which, you know, soon within the next few years going to be more prevalent. But at the same time, you know, that element where you have a little bit of time for actually analyzing that purchase and deciding, does it make sense with my lifestyle? Does it make sense with what I want to express to other people? And really sort of looking at the pros and cons then, that's when you're sort of making a decision, maybe that wasn't the best of a purchase.
It's intriguing to find that in Cardiff, people are most likely to actually return items from their New Year wardrobes, followed by those in London and Sheffield. Any particular reason for the Welsh deciding to actually say, that's it, we've had enough now, it can go back?
To be honest, I'm not sure why. There doesn't seem to be much of a drastic regional differences in, you know, in consumer behavior within the UK. You know, perhaps they just sort of indulge themselves more. I don't know, but I'm speculating right now, honestly.
And women also are more likely to feel guilty about their purchases than men. 11% of women return their impulse buys, as opposed to 6% of males. Have you ever returned a purchase, Kate, and said, that's it, I can't, I made a big bad decision there, it's got to go back?
Well, you forgot you're talking to a consumer psychologist, so
indeed.
I kind of analyze my purchases. So I'm probably not the best example of it. I generally don't return my purchases because I sort of use good tactics in my decision making and sort of make sure that I don't buy impulsively. But it does happen to me that I buy things that I don't really wear then. But then a lot of the times I can't be bothered or I don't have time or I haven't used Collect Plus, hence, you know, I haven't returned them. You know, people will naturally return those items, you know, especially the ones that are bought in sales, because there's even less of a time and effort being placed into decision making then.
I had a wry smile with the figure that came out that suggested that over 2 million people would be sending back fitness wear in the not-too-distant future as those New Year's fitness regimes, effectively the New Year resolution effectively became, we can't go on with this, sends the fitness clothes back. As the founder, in fact, of Style Psychology Limited, Kate, what is your advice in terms of ensuring that, you know, OK, we can make use of Collect Plus, it's the UK's largest independent store-based parcel delivery and return service, so you could use that as a way of returning your clothes. But if you wanted to kind of avoid that hurdle, is it a case of planning? Is it a case of preparation? What would you suggest in terms of preventing folk suffering from buyer's remorse?
So, you know, we will all at some point in time suffer from buyer's remorse, especially when we go on holidays and buy things that we don't really need. But simply,
surely,
I just...
surely not the Spanish donkey. I mean, you know, that's no,
definitely
sombrero, exactly.
Not that yeah. one. But generally, allow yourself to browse. Remember that those things that are actually in sales will still be there tomorrow and a day after. They're really not going to disappear. There's so much things in stores at the moment. There's actually too many that they're producing. So they will be there in stores. So stop yourself and, you know, don't be sort of so impulsive in that decision just because you feel that it's going to disappear tomorrow. Unless it's a sample sale or, I don't know, limited edition, one only pair in the whole London because you've already searched for it and you already decided that it suits 5 items in your wardrobe, then probably you have another day or two to think about it. Then just sort of, you know, be a little bit aware also of things that some of the retailers are implementing in terms of increasing impulse buys. So, for example, if you're going into a store that has dimmed lighting, it is much more likely that you're going to be impulsive in your decision making than if it has a bright lighting. So be careful of some of those elements. And last but not least, the best thing is always brief, stop yourself, go and browse in another store, go and have a coffee, then come back if you really still want it.
And presumably, similar advice occurs even if you're shopping online. Take time out to breathe, take time out to reflect on the whole process. Bear in mind that, you know, these are significant decisions that you're actually making. Don't necessarily actually jump in and actually take that initial gut feeling.
Yes, absolutely. And also, let's remember that, you know, a lot of us are doing online shopping while we sort of on a bus or, you know, in an evening relaxing while watching a movie and having a drink. Then probably it's not the best sort of, you know, amount of headspace to make a proper decision. So, you know, maybe, yes, browse, save it to your list and then look at it with your fresh mind, I don't know, on Saturday morning when you're drinking your coffee.
Exactly. Of course, Kate, as a woman, you can quite clearly multitask to that effect of watching a movie and do shopping at the same time. As a
totally.
Man,
it would and end, responding to an email as well.
Exactly. It would just end in disaster if I tried to do that. So it's just, don't do it. Yeah. Focus. Focus will go key things. Finally, if people are listening to this and they say, I quite fancy getting in touch with Collect Plus, they did the survey, etc., I'll find out more details about this, where would you suggest they should go, Kate?
Absolutely. They can visit their website, collectplus.co.uk, and they're going to have the press release with further details on that research, as well as if you want to find out your nearest store, they have an opportunity on the website to do so, or you can download their app, which makes it even easier for you to find the nearest store, return the item, print your label, and everything else that you need for returning or sending any parcel.
And that, Kate Nightingale, is why you are clearly the expert in consumer behaviour and psychology at London College of Fashion, and indeed the founder of Style Psychology Limited. It's been a joy connecting with you today. Have you had a reasonably interesting telephonic link with us today, Kate Nightingale?
Very nice. Thank you very much, Alex, for this lovely conversation.
So I take it we can hopefully connect as 2018 heads through the months and find out more about style psychology, fashion, consumerism and so on. Will you be kind enough to return?
Absolutely. Will be my pleasure.
Pet Shop Boys and It's a Sin, takes out of a sequence which featured, of course, Kate Nightingale, style psychologist, and Dick and Dom with At Their Bungalow. Coming up next, Danny Kerr, England and Harlequins rugby player, and Alistair McQueen from Aviva, talking about the community group impact that occurs throughout Britain, in which 32 million British folk have actually felt the positive impact of community groups, with, of course, the announcement of the Aviva Community Fund winners announced this week. Lots to talk about after Peter Gabriel. Games Without Frontiers. Not, of course, that we'd actually encourage Games Without Frontiers, because even rugby has to have some rules about the whole sort of system. Quite rightly so, too. As mentioned, we're delighted to welcome now a dynamic duo of fabulous capabilities and quality. First of all, England and Harlequins rugby player extraordinaire Danny Kerr. How are you, Danny?
I'm very well, thank you. How are you?
Excellent, very good indeed. And Aviva spokesperson Alistair McQueen. How are you, Alistair?
I'm very well. Good morning to you too.
Marvellous. Alistair, I can come to you first, because this is the week where clearly the Aviva Community Fund winners have been announced. Over 500 community groups have been awarded funding from £1,000 to £25,000. That's all good news, isn't it, Alistair?
It's phenomenal news. This was a project that Aviva started 3 years ago. We thought we should be investing in local communities. We have employees and we have customers all over the country, and we thought we should give some money back. It started in a small project 3 years ago. It's just gone incredibly from strength to strength. Last year, we invited any local community group to come forward to bid for some money. Over 6,000 projects came forward. This week, we've announced over 500 winners receiving, as you say, between £1,000 and £25,000 for the local community groups. And incredibly, 5.5 million votes were cast last year to decide which of those groups should be winning it. So great way for us to give back to local communities up and down and around the country. And we'll be doing it all again later this year. So celebrate this year's winners and get ready for next year too.
Danny, when we spoke in 2017 about the importance of the Aviva Fund and so on, you were very passionate then about the way in which community and sport can work together. Presumably this is just validation of your own commitment to being not only a role model with London's Harlequins and, of course, the England international side, but also seeing the good things that community groups can get involved with sport and other things.
Oh, it's been brilliant. Obviously, talking from a sporting background, I know how important my local community was to pave the way for me to be here sat talking to you now. So what Aviva are doing is brilliant, and the winners hopefully are very happy, and the money's going to go to some fantastic causes.
When you bear in mind that local charities, mental health groups and clubs for the elderly are all being perceived as doing the most positive work in British communities, very much they are the glue that hold us together as a society, possibly.
Yeah, massively. I mean, I visited a local charity called Feast last year, which is an unbelievable cause. They basically take food from supermarkets that would be thrown away, and literally tons and tons of food that would just go in the bin. They take it and they take it to a homeless shelter, and I think once or twice a week cook a meal for any of the homeless that live in that local community. And things like that just hit home that people are doing that off their own back. They're not getting paid to do it. They're taking their own time. And they're committing to something like that, which for the community is the greater good.
Over 4.7 million folk got involved with one of the community groups for the first time last year, the highest uptake for the last 5 years. That must put a big smile on your face, Alistair.
It's huge. I mean, that's an incredible number. That's nearly 1 in 10 people in the UK. We've also found that 1 in 2 people, whether they're involved or not, feel that they've benefited from local community groups. We're not here talking about big businesses. We're talking about, as Danny says, local sports clubs, local clubs for the elderly, local wellbeing clubs. These local groups of volunteers that get together to give their own time to help their own local community. And Aviva said, you know what, we should be helping them along the way with a little bit of money between £1,000 and £25,000. This week, we're celebrating the over 500 local clubs that have won, and we're going to help them through 2018. And as I said, later on this year, we're inviting more and more clubs to come forward and say, you know what, I'd benefit from a little bit of money. Come to the Aviva Community Fund, and hopefully you could be a winner later in 2018.
Clearly, the place to go if you're actually looking to follow anybody on Twitter is at Danny Kerr. But if we're talking about the joys of the Aviva package at Aviva UK, Danny, would you suggest that people should go to the Aviva Fund to find out more about how they might possibly apply for and maybe be successful with the Aviva Community Fund?
Oh, without a doubt. Obviously, have a look and see which groups have been successful in your community, but then also get your thinking caps on for later in the year, as Alistair says, because there's more money, there's more funding that's going to be available, so get submitting your causes.
Now, over the years, being a little bit off-tangent here, Alistair, I've noticed that Scotland haven't been doing so well in terms of the rugby side of things. It's fair to say, isn't it, really?
I mean, I'd rather you didn't raise well, I'm sat next to Danny, and I'm trying to be friends with them, but this is a touchy subject.
I just thought that was the case. I mean, Danny, can we look forward to another success in the upcoming Six Nations against our friends from the border?
Oh, that's obviously our hope. I'm sure they can't wait for it to welcome us to Murrayfield this year. It's going to be a cracking game. Obviously, all our focus is on the first game. We go to Rome and play Italy, and my old coach at Harlequins, Conor O'Shea, who's at the helm there. So we know how tough that's going to be. And I think the beauty of the tournament is anyone can beat anyone on their day, and that's why people love it. That's why we love playing in it. So it's going to be a cracking tournament, and yeah, hopefully we're the successful ones at the end.
It's awesome. I'm sure it's a wonderful thing, and people will be sort of saying, let's go for the whole thing, because, of course, the Rugby World Cup will be coming around before we know where we are, and it's just it's amazing stuff. It's been fabulous sharing some thoughts with your good selves today. Danny Kerr, England and Harlequins legend, I think we'll say. Not just rugby player, legend
very
from
good.
That point of view. And, of course, well, equally legendary Aviva spokesperson, Alistair McQueen. I know you're legendary. Exactly, you are. Gentlemen, it's been fabulous touching base with your good selves. Hopefully you've had a reasonably interesting telephone link. Can we look forward to connecting with you again in the forthcoming few months of 2018, etc., and keep us appraised of how Aviva is continuing this excellent work.
We can indeed. Keep your eyes out. Aviva Community Fund again this year.
We often hear about dry January. Some might actually say it's important to actually have a full dry year and so on. But nevertheless, there's still an awful lot of pressure within the media to drink to cope. I drink to forget. I drink to celebrate. Perhaps too much drinking is taking place. Certainly 47% of men and women who said they had drunk alcohol in the last year did so to cheer themselves up when they're in a bad mood. And 2 in 5 said that they drunk alcohol because it helps when they feel depressed or nervous. Now, to address some of the issues that clearly are having an impact on people's lives here, we're delighted to welcome the Chief Executive of Drinkaware, the fabulous Elaine Hindle. How are you, Elaine?
Good morning. I'm good, thank you.
Good. Elaine, talk to us about this survey that's been produced that clearly, in terms of the Drinkaware YouGov research, suggests that folk are, you know, clearly not being sensible when it comes to their alcoholic consumption.
Yeah, this is a piece of research that Drinkaware did with YouGov, as you suggested. And what we found was that, surprisingly, 3 in 5 people said they were drinking to help them cope with the day-to-day pressures of life. You know, as you said, whether it's to help them cheer up in a bad mood or whether they were feeling depressed or anxious. And what we found particularly concerning is this effect is more pronounced amongst people who drink more, as you might expect, but also people who are less well-off. And people who might be dealing with a range of other problems as well, whether it's financial or housing or just other concerns. And when day-to-day life is hard, what we're seeing is people are using alcohol as a way to simply to get through the day.
Historically, of course, you can go back to the challenges we had with gin back in the day when Hogarth was doing images for Dickens of the way in which the working classes, etc., couldn't handle drink and so on. Have we really progressed that far now? We're a couple of centuries down the line and in the 21st century as opposed to the 19th?
You know, I think what I don't want to do is suggest in any way that this is, you know, sort of judging people. That, you know, some people can handle drink and some people can't. This is about, actually, I think, just day-to-day life now becoming really stressful. And for people who are thinking, how do I make ends meet? How do I manage family? How do I manage an uncertain job? How do I cope with uncertain financial situations? Alcohol is sort of so readily available now that it's become something that culturally, I think, lots of us turn to as a way to cope with challenges. But what's important, I think, for all of us to remember is that in the long term, you know, having an odd drink to say I've had a bad day is not what we're talking about here. What we are concerned about is that in the long term, regularly drinking more than is recommended by the chief medical officers is associated with anxiety and depression of in and of itself. So it's not a solution. And what we're concerned about is when it becomes a vicious cycle. You know, people are drinking to cope and then they're finding they're less able to cope well. And alcohol can have a long-term negative impact on mental health when drunk to excess.
As well as the liver, of course. In terms of not just people suffering from challenges and stress and so on, but students as well, a very clear area, category, where in many ways there's still a pressure, an unwarranted pressure, admittedly, but a pressure to effectively celebrate with booze and so on. Is that something which often carries on into graduate life, where people actually think, oh, well, I started drinking as a student and it was okay then and I can handle it now, and they can't really?
Well, that's a really interesting point, because what we're beginning to see now in the evidence around drinking patterns, and we do a lot of research in DrinkAware about, you know, how different groups of people drink, students are less likely now to be drinking excessively than their parents' generation. So we're much more concerned now about people over 45 whose drinking, as you rightly say, started, you know, we were at university in the 80s, and developed drinking patterns then that we've carried into our older adult life. So we're beginning to see that people over 45, over 50, are much more likely to be drinking daily and are more likely to be drinking more than the recommended level of 14 units per week. And in fact, in the student population, we have a significant proportion of young people who don't drink at all or who drink very little. So I think the perception is that you know, that we're concerned about only young adults here, but actually we're equally concerned about older groups of people, their parents or even their grandparents.
Yes, it's come to something where you actually have parents and grandparents behaving badly. However, in terms of the best way to be aware of issues and challenges with respect to this, and to think about ways to cope, because it's all very well we're talking about, oh, you shouldn't drink, you shouldn't do this, and you shouldn't do that, and so on. What are the alternative strategies, and where can people go to find out about some of the things to not only raise their own awareness, but also perhaps put some plans in place to ensure that they don't fall foul of what we've been discussing today?
Yeah. Well, the first question we're always asked is, am I drinking too much? And there is a simple self-assessment, there's one on our website at DrinkAware, but also you could ask your GP perhaps to run through that assessment with you to help you answer that question. Am I drinking too much? Is my drinking a concern? But if you are regularly drinking more than 14 units, which is about 6 pints or 6 average glasses of wine, then you ought to be thinking about cutting back to keep your risk to your health and your mental health low. And then in terms of tips and advice, there's a lot of advice out there on our website, on NHS Choices and on others, things you can do to help you think about cutting back. One good tip that seems to work for a lot of people is taking days off, not drinking every day of the week, but taking 2 or 3 days off and having a break so that you're not getting into that habitual drinking behaviour of drinking every day.
And to return to where we came in, the notion of dry January, is that something that can help as well? The sort of notion that, you know, after imbibing, it's important to in some ways, take a couple of weeks or a month off and again, sort of alternate and stagger your drinking?
Anything that can help people reset and sort of take back control of their drinking has got to be a good thing. So if people are choosing to have a dry January, coming back into February in a more modest way and in a more moderate way is a really good thing to do. There are lots of apps, for example, out there that can help people get into a more moderate pattern of drinking when they do take back, you know, go back to alcohol in February if that's what they choose to do. But also just simply cutting back will also have some fairly short-term and immediate health benefits. So, for example, you will begin to sleep better. You might lose a couple of pounds if you've taken January off alcohol. You'll certainly be saving money, and you'll be thinking more clearly by the end of a month without alcohol. So anything that helps people take a break, I think, is a good thing, whether it's dry January or simply cutting back.
Well, we knew we'd get some very sage and important advice, Elaine. So have you had a reasonably interesting telephonic link? And I trust it hasn't driven you to drink today.
No, it certainly has not.
That's good. Well, hopefully we'll connect again during 2018 and keep us aware of the excellent work that you do as Chief Executive of Drink Aware. Elaine Hindle, many thanks indeed. Take care now.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
This is Liquid, ring a ding a ding. I want those 3 grand band tickets, man. What do you think? Time.
I'm alive.
I woke up again this morning with the sun in my eyes. When Mike came over with a script surprise. A mafioso story with a twist. A 2-1 fool, Julie, you are here to get your ass out of bed. Hey. He said, I'll explain it on the way.
But we did nothing, absolutely nothing that day. And I said, what the hell am I doing drinking in L.A. at 26?
Over the years, we've had dry January. We still have dry January. Now we have veganuary. We have a whole range of things because clearly new year, new you, it's time for resolutions and so on. But a recent survey commissioned by Amazon has suggested that actually almost half of Britons who set new goals for 2018 will have given them up pretty much by next week. To address this, we're delighted to welcome author and ace professor of psychology extraordinaire, the amazing Professor Richard Wiseman. How are you, Richard?
I'm very good, thank you. How are you?
Great. Excellent stuff. Motivated to obviously move forward with a New Year resolution of positivity throughout from that basis.
Even
in terms of Veganuary, which, again, is an extraordinary thing. But in terms of this whole sequence, why is it that, you know, some people have even given up on making New Year's resolutions because they just think, what's the point? We'll break it by the middle of January.
Well, I think the answer lies in the survey, which is around about 40% of people say the reason they're giving up is simply a lack of willpower. And so they're going, the only way I can change is to really just rely on my willpower, to that kind of force of will. The problem is that, as you know, complicated days, lots of demands on our time and energy, actually that does get eaten up quite quickly. So the key thing is to understand the psychology of it, some of the hints and tips that will get you through, rather than simply relying on willpower.
Now, with this veganuary, and I'm often mindful of the Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, Douglas Adams, who, of course, had Vogans, not to be confused with vegans, different line entirely. It's a different sort of area there. But in terms of vegans, this is something which, you know, has moved from being a kind of fringe activity where people are saying, oh, well, very strange vegans and so on. But because, you know, more and more people are actually saying, we care about the planet, we want to be concerned about what's happening in terms of vegan deodorant and so on, organic coconut, etc., tofu and so on. Is this something which actually helps in terms of that New Year resolution because people actually see that they can actually in some small way make a difference themselves?
I think there's a couple of things going on there. One is that it's just good for you psychologically to feel in control of your life. So whatever change you want to make, whether it's becoming a vegan for a month or whatever it is, as long as you can see it through, that's just good for you. What you don't want to do is feel that you're out of control, essentially, and that you can't make the change and become a better person. But also what's really interesting, as you say, with the vegan side of things, is if you're looking at the bigger picture, what's good for other people as well as yourself, that's almost certainly good for your well-being as well. So that's really interesting to see that one come up. But there's lots of other unusual resolutions which came out the survey as well. So a lot of people saying they want to actually improve the quality of their sleep, which is a really good idea because willpower linked very directly with sleep. So we're seeing, you know, some of those more traditional resolutions drop away and some of these more exciting ones take their place.
Yes, I was particularly intrigued in that. Almost a third of those surveyed in the East Midlands actually said that getting more sleep was one of their main goals. I just thought it was being good to people and kind and celebrating positivity from that point of view. Also, enhanced mental health, that's a very high scorer in terms of the way, making sure that that's top of their agenda. I mean, is it possible to do that, to actually, in a sense, have a workout for the mind?
I think it is. I mean, often it's a question of being positive, thinking about what you can do rather than what you can't do, thinking about helping others, thinking of remembering what you have in your life in terms of gratitude and so on. So all, again, those simple tips have a very big impact. So interesting to see that top of the survey, actually. So about a third of the country are really pointing towards mental health and well-being and happiness.
Interesting to see the top four tips that you've put together, Richard, in terms of working through this whole process, the SMCG scenario from that point of view, starting off with start and then don't stop.
Absolutely. So this notion of, rather than giving up something, which is a bit of a negative notion, the idea of starting with something new is a great idea. And in fact, actually, Amazon have a special store, which is New Year, New You, where they've got all sorts of ideas about, you know, what you can start new in terms of getting fit or eating well or whatever it is. So, yeah, that positive idea, don't give up something, start something new.
And the M, of course, being morning glory, which I thought was some kind of euphemism at one stage. But I thought, no, it's a completely different thing entirely. It's developing habits in the morning, of course. That's the key thing.
That's right. That's when your willpower is at its maximum, when you get out in the first couple of hours of the day. So if you are going to start something new, if you can, that's a good time to be doing it, particularly at the weekends, rather than pushing everything off to the evening when you feel tired and you just haven't got that willpower there.
These days, of course, with social media, Bluetooth and so on, people can quite happily apparently be talking to other people or indeed themselves. But talking about yourself in the third person, apparently calling yourself out, that's something else you put forward as a possible strategy.
Yeah, it's a great bit of research underpinned with quite a few experiments where a lot of people, when they talk to themselves to increase their willpower, they'll say, I can do it. Come on, I can do it. It's not such a great idea. It's much better if you shift that into the second person. You can do it. You take an outside perspective on yourself, and it's much more likely to boost your willpower.
And finally, grab a buddy, a GAB, ensuring that you actually have that motivation of having a wingman or wing person with you.
Absolutely. Friends and family, this is where they come into play. Telling them what you're going to do that's new and exciting, and then sending them reports. Whether they read them or not doesn't matter, but sending over those reports really helps keep you yourself in the account. And so, again, boost that the chances of success.
If we've captured anybody's interest over the last few moments and they say, this is great, but I want to find out more, I want to go to other places in addition to the whole sort of systems about finding out how to keep on going, where would you suggest, Richard?
Well, as I said before, amazon.co.uk/New Year New You. Is where the store is, with loads of ideas there about what you can start new as the new year starts off.
And in terms of your own research, Richard, I mean, over the last 10 years, you've been obviously researching a range of unusual psychological phenomena. Are there distinctive trends that are emerging in the 21st century? Are our psyches responding to the technology, the techno world that we are in? Or is it just a case of, no, we can go back to Freud's time and it'll be exactly the same?
Well, psychologists don't tend to talk too much about Freud now. He's got all sorts of strange ideas about unconscious motivations and so on. But I think what's really interesting is that psychology is becoming a lot more practical. So everything we've been talking about this morning, underpinned by research, underpinned by experiments, and it's stuff that's really simple and really makes a difference.
The advent of the social sciences in the 1930s, this trying to understand what is it about human beings that makes us so fascinating and worthwhile. It's amazing. And who better than author and professor of psychology extraordinaire, as we said, than Richard Wiseman, to share that with us, as you have just done. Richard, have you had a reasonably interesting telephonic link with us on the programme today?
It's been fascinating, thank you.
In which case, can we look forward to hopefully a New Year's resolution feature you again before the end of 2018?
Of course, of course. Well, please, ask me back anytime at all.
Mars in the background, featuring Cardi B. Time for the roll up honour of today's Midweek Drive Morning Edition. Thanks to Gabriella Peralta, Richard Fitzwilliams, Ian Lennox, Dick and Dom, Kate Nightingale, Alistair Queen, Danny Kerr, Elaine Hindle, and Professor Richard Wiseman, and you, dear listener, for actually being with us for however long you have been. This has been Midweek Drive Morning Edition with Alex Levchik on Siren Radio. Great stuff coming through all through the day as far as Siren Radio is actually concerned, including a new Stone Tapes edition focusing on Egyptian mummies just after 7 p.m. this very evening on Siren Radio. We'll be back next week with the Midweek Drive on Wednesday and Midweek Drive Morning Edition on Thursday, but there's a whole heap of 160-odd hours worth of good stuff on Siren Radio between between now and then. So enjoy, be happy. Let us grab your ladies if you're